Now, you'll know her voice if you listen to ABC News Radio in the afternoons or on the weekends. Tracy Holmes has been a journalist for 25 years and in that time has interviewed prime ministers, presidents, kings and sheikhs. And of course, a few sports stars as well. So she arms herself with books, though, and that's why she's here to talk to us this morning. From a very large selection, Tracy has chosen the top three books she read this year and she joins me now to review them. Tracy, let's start with the first.
Okay, I'd like to start with The Bolt Supremacy, Inside Jamaica's Sprint Factory by Richard Moore. I've only just finished it. It's fabulous, and I think anyone that follows sport, whether closely or just from afar, someone that just has a passing interest in the Olympic Games, everybody knows who Usain Bolt is. And I guess one of the challenges of being a sports star these days is that the minute you're any good at something or the minute you're much better than somebody, the drug question arises. Richard Moore has been following drugs in sport for quite some time. He's written numerous other books. But he goes to Jamaica and he goes and visits as many people as possible and tries to get as many stories as possible. And what he uncovers is this incredible machine of training and sprinting culture, and the fact that they stop athletes going to the US to train at colleges now. They keep them at home amongst the people they love. And at the end of the book, you're kind of left wondering. He doesn't say one way or the other. You think that he sets out to prove that there must be a culture of drugs. But by the end of the book, I think he's kind of, you know, half a dozen here, six over there, because there's so much more to this story. And it goes right back to the slave trade and early politics and the foundations of Jamaica, and the fittest and the strongest survived. And these are the people that are now creating the world's fastest runners.
Well, that's fascinating. So Jamaica is obviously nationally obsessed with sprinting. And in your mind, and possibly in the author's mind, it's an open question as to whether just total focus can lead to results that could be described as
Yeah, and
doping.
I think what's interesting is you can even make some comparisons to what we're seeing with the West Indies cricket team here at the moment, which is just failing dismally against Australia. They've just really lost their way. And yet you go to a place like Jamaica where so many great cricketers came from, and now everybody is running. And it starts at a very, very young age, primary school. They have these incredible meets. And then once they get to high school, they have these age divisions. Jamaica now proudly claims that they own the fastest 100-metre runners in every single age division on the planet.
Whoa.
And, I mean, it's quite incredible. Their school carnival that comes once a year, they bring all of the high schools together. It's in Jamaica, it's as big as the Olympics, because this is where you see all of the stars of the future. This is where Usain Bolt came from and all of his colleagues, both men and women. And it's just the intensity with which they run. And there's other countries that have done similar things. The South Koreans have done it with short track speed skating. The Finns have done it with javelin throwing. You could say that Australia has done it with swimming, where you focus on a sport and make it your own. And you become very successful at it, because success breeds other success. You become better at coaching. You become inspired by those around you. The competition is so strong. Many people will say it's tougher to win the age championship in Jamaica than it is to win the Olympic Games.
Wow. Well, your second book is something completely different.
Is it this one, Citizen?
Citizen,
yeah.
A book-length poem.
It is a book-length poem. It's an incredible book. It's about 150-60 pages long, so you can read it quite quickly, but it's one that you can keep going back to again and again and again and just see more depth every time you look at it. It's by Claudia Rankine, who is a very famous poet inside the US. She's also an academic. And in this particular book, she focuses on many of the names that we've come to know in the last few years, Rodney King, Trayvon Martin, the swearing in of President Obama, Serena Williams, and basically tells this story in a very poetic way about the fact that there's not a black person in the US that doesn't know what it's like to look somebody in the eye and see either fear or hatred. And it details how that happens in the most simplest of terms, whether sitting on a train, bumping into somebody and spilling coffee, and the reactions that you get. But there's one poem in particular called Stop and Frisk, and she keeps coming back to these verses, which really haunt you. One in particular is this: and still you are not the guy, and still you fit the description, because there is only one guy who is always the guy, fitting the description. And you think about even the news we've had in the last week coming out of the US, more shootings of black people, the trial of the two police officers that were involved in killing the little boy with a toy gun. And this is what she's talking about. You know, you always fit the description. A little white boy could be playing with a toy gun. The result is not going to be the same. And it's really, like I say, it's haunting. It's chilling in ways, but it also opens a window. You start to understand that, why do people always go on about racism? Surely it's not as bad as all that. You know, why can't people get on with it? Why can't they move forward? And I think she gives you 1,000 reasons why.
She was, of course, born and spent her early childhood in Jamaica. Does she ever reflect on that? Does she see herself, feel herself to be fully a citizen of the US, or does she, I suppose, draw on both cultures?
Yeah, she does, but I don't think you can separate one from the other. It's not as though, you know, what came before is not a part of what is now. And you get that from, I think, people of colour from all around the world. They certainly know their roots because these stories are handed down time and time again. And you might be in a new place, but it comes back to that whole question of identity and how other people see you. And the way you feel and the way you see yourself is not necessarily how other people are going to see you or how they're going to respond to you. And that's the challenge. It's almost as though we create an environment where people have to keep justifying themselves over and over again.
Apart from anything else, it's quite tiring.
Exactly. Yeah, totally, totally.
Grinds you down.
And why should you have to? And that's, I think, one of the reasons she, you know, she holds Serena Williams up, all of her anger and aggression and everything else that is on display so often, as a bit of a champion. Because why should you have to put up with that again and again? Why should you have to continually justify who you are or somebody's idea of who you are? Because they don't have to. Mm. And by the mere colour of their skin, they have to keep doing this. And as you say, terribly tiring. And in the end, you would feel like, you know, taking the Serena Williams option.
So, Tracy, there's so many, I mean, you've got a stack more books, that lots of different genres. How do you choose what you will read? What draws you to
books?
Oh,
well, look, I've got a great husband and our interests are so different.
You're outsourcing it, in other words. Yeah.
Well, no, not completely. We swap. We pick up books for each other and we say, you read this, now you read that. And it's really interesting. And, of course, we've got kids as well whose interests are different again. But I think also by travelling around the world, I was travelling when I was very young. My mum and dad took off when I was about 2.5 years old. So I've grown up in so many different places with so many different people and so many different cultures. And so I'm interested in how all of those things impact on what could otherwise be a fairly, you know, mundane life, and how all of those things come together, and how everyone has a story. I'm convinced that you could walk down the street and the first six people you stop and meet, you could write a book about them because everyone has a story. And so that does make it difficult.
It does make it difficult. Now, I do want to ask you about the Paul Fisher book called A Kim Jong-il Production. The backstory to this book is about the North Korean dictator's obsession with establishing a film industry. Sounds like something out of a Hollywood movie. Tell us about it.
You would not think it's a true story. You really wouldn't. And I think what happens is you end up having the idea reinforced that North Korea is a very, very odd place where reality and fantasy are all kind of combined because they've got no idea what reality is for the rest of the world. And so what happens is a South Korean film star, Choi Yoon-hee, and her film director husband, Shin Sung-ok, end up being kidnapped from Hong Kong. And Kim Jong-il's idea is that he wants to make better films. He's already making films in North Korea. He's already in charge of the propaganda department. But he knows they're just not like the blockbusters from South Korea, and they're not like the Hollywood blockbusters that he loves. And he has this sort of pirate industry going where he records films from all around the world and just consumes them day in, day out. So he kidnaps these two and says, right, you're now working for me, and can't understand why they don't feel that reciprocal love. He thinks he's done a wonderful favour for them. You can come here, do these films with me, and we'll reunite the two careers, and you'll be my salespeople. It's a fascinating story and just incredible. They were divorced by the time he kidnapped them.
Did he know that?
He knew that, but he recommended that they get remarried and work as a team. And they did. Because who else did they have in North Korea? Anyway, the story unfolds. It's just incredible. Then they end up going to Vienna for a film festival and they defect to the USA. Kim Jong-il then thinks that the USA has kidnapped them. It's a whole story of intrigue. They then fear going back to South Korea because they don't think anyone in South Korea is going to believe their story.
Yeah.
Eventually they do. But yeah, what an amazing journey.
Oh, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because books about North Korea, they always, the level of paranoia that they try to portray does lead to situations where you can have just a comedy of errors. It's almost like the novel, if it's fictional, writes itself, because intense paranoia can lead to all these sort of minor catastrophes escalating.
It's just amazing. I'll tell you a very quick story. A friend of mine is a South Korean ambassador and a former ambassador, and she was involved in the very early stages of the meetings between North and South, looking at reunification, which these ongoing discussions. And she was saying that she went up to North Korea for a meeting and, you know, the same sort of three girls who looked beautiful, lovely makeup, parasols, every time they walked outside of the government building, these same three girls were marching backward and forward. So everything is staged for the international visitor. Then when the reciprocal meeting happened and the North Koreans came to Seoul, they finished their meeting, they walked outside to have a cigarette or whatever they were doing, and this one man pulled her aside and said, "Look, I really hope you don't mind me asking, but how on earth did you organise all of this? You know, the lights, the buildings, the cars, the people." And she said, "Well, it's not organised. It's not staged. This is the city. This is how we live 24/7.
Wow.
Which takes me
and
back to...
And he was just asking for some production tips, really.
Exactly. Production tips. Again, the fascination with the film. But at the time of this kidnapping, remember, North and South Korea, in some respects, North Korea was in a better position than South Korea. And then the two kind of swapped, you know, now there is just no comparison whatsoever. But back in these days when it all took place, there was still some kind of competition for who was worse off.
Tracy Holmes, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming in and talking books.
Thanks, Sarah.
Tracy Holmes is a presenter on ABC News Radio.